This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the writer Liz Lochhead. Poetry and plays and prose have flowed from her pen for nigh on 45 years. A storyteller at heart, she writes, she says, for consolation and for fun. We read it and hear it and enjoy it for the fresh distinction she brings to the everyday business of life. From warrant sales to serial monogamy, her eye and ear capture moments and moods with considerable craft and heart and humour. Her use of the vernacular ties her unmistakably to Scotland. Indeed, she spent 5 years as its national poet. But in truth, her life has ranged far and wide. Canada, Turkey, America, and even England have at times been her home. She says of her poems, they seem as naked and as intimate as any journal, and sometimes painfully so. So welcome, Liz Lochhead.
I can't remember.
You did say that. You're at that stage now in your life and also by reputation where you do collected works, and that must necessitate you looking back and reading and analysing the stuff from your early years of writing. Going back through your life, through your work, what's the sensation? What does that feel like?
It feels very strange. Sometimes you find things, getting ready for this programme, you sometimes find things that you can't remember, and they come back very sharply to you, as if you'd never written them or never connected with them in that way. But it makes me realise that all the time I have been mediating my life through making pictures with words. You know, I think they're quite visual. I hope they're quite visual, because I went to art school, perhaps.
You were awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry in 2015?
Well, it was for 2015, but it was in February 2016 that I was given this gong. It was fantastic.
What did that mean to you?
An enormous surprise and a slightly surreal feeling, as if that's not the kind of thing that happens to me. The Queen was really wonderful. She was very funny. She told me about meeting Edith Sitwell when she was really young, and her and her sister. She said, Ma and Pa took us to poetry readings. We were far too young. She said, Margaret and I were quite naughty. We got the giggles. And she asked us, Caroline and I, did we ever get giggles in poetry readings? And we both looked at each other and said, yes, we do.
So this is Caroline Duffy.
Caroline Duffy, yes.
I've read that you began to write poetry as a youngster because you couldn't sing. I don't know if that's right or not. But I wonder, what's your relationship with music?
Very, very important. Remembering being told that I couldn't sing. You know, when Miss Pettigrew, the peripatetic music teacher.
There's a poem
said,
in that.
Yeah, when she said, somebody's groaning, and came round and listened, and she said to me, just you do silent singing.
Was it because your voice was deep?
No, I just couldn't sing. I was out of tune. But I was singing away with great enthusiasm. I mean, you should never do that to somebody that's enjoying themselves.
Let's go to the music, Liz Lochhead. Tell me then about your first one. What are we going to hear first off this morning?
Well, we're going to hear Joni Mitchell. We're going to hear the very start of Blue. You know, the album Blue. It was very hard to even pick even which Joni Mitchell to have, far less pick which 8 records. This just starts the whole album. And I think if I'm in the desert island and I hear that, I'll be able to sing. You know, if there'll be a silent singing inside a jukebox in my head, the whole album. I used to think I was Joni Mitchell when I was at art school. I did. Once I started writing poems, I would think to myself, Joni Mitchell is me, except my wee rhymey things don't have music to them, and I can't sing, and I live in Motherwell, not California.
I am on a lonely road, and I am travelling, 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 looking for something. What can it be? Oh, I hate you some, I hate you some, I love you some. Oh, I love you when I forget about. Strong, I wanna live alone, I wanna belong to the living. Alive, alive, I wanna get up and drive, wanna wreck my stockings in some.
Poetry indeed, Liz Lochhead. That was Joni Mitchell singing All I Want. Let's talk for a moment about the preoccupation that people often have, and it seems to begin in schools, of decoding poetry. Let's find out what the poet was really talking about. What do you make of that?
It's rubbish. Of course they're talking about other things as well, but if the story and the surface doesn't make sense... I mean, I met a wee boy once and he said, see, when you wrote that poem about that bull, what were you really trying to say? And I thought, that really? That's what you're doing when you're trying to write poetry. You're trying to get it into the words that... Of course I know that that particular poem was about repression and sexuality and darkness and light and so on, but if it wasn't about a bull and a wee girl looking at him, it wouldn't be about anything. Metaphors have got to work as a plain story first.
Is your resistance to it also maybe based on the fact that you feel it puts a lot of people off? Or maybe I can't work out what this is about?
Yes. When people feel that they're wrong, they're right. It's not the teacher that's right saying... I mean, some people have told me that they, you know, people have said this and that, and they've said, I asked her, and she said it wasn't that at all, you know? I definitely think poetry is about communicating. First of all, to myself, and then to other people, I suppose. I mean, if people couldn't make head or tail of something, I would still be glad I'd written it, but I probably wouldn't read it in public. But, you know, like when I look at The Guardian on a Saturday, maybe 2 out of 5 poems, I can't make head or tail of what they're trying to do. I don't have the clue in. And I see that there's wordplay, but the wee clue that could have taken me there is missing. And the other 3 surprise me and delight me.
Let's go to your next piece of music then, Liz Lochhead. Tell me about your second one today. What are we going to hear?
This is Burns. This is probably one of Burns' most beautiful songs ever. And that was a man that wrote a hell of a lot of beautiful songs. A man who wrote songs when he stopped being able to write poetry towards the end of his life. The last 10 years of Burns' life, he only wrote one poem, one major poem, which is Tam O'Shanter. But he wrote hundreds and hundreds of songs. He rode around Scotland with a fiddle, and it was his kind of recording thing. He would learn tunes and then he would play around with them in the inn and begin to write songs to fit that tune and so on. Oh, and it cheers me up. He was apparently not a good singer at all, but he wrote great songs. And this is my friend Michael Marra, who also wrote truly wonderful songs and isn't nearly as well known as he should be.
There's naught but care on every hand, and every hour that passes, oh, what signifies the life, oh man, and 24 the lasses, oh, green grow the rashes, oh, green grow.
That was Michael Marra with Mr. McFall's Chamber and Green Grow the Rashes O. After the war was the dull country I was born in, so went to your poem, Liz Lochhead. Tell me a bit more then about your background. It was Boxing Day, 1947.
Yep. My mother thought she had indigestion after eating a whole jar of Piccalilli. That was her pregnancy, whatever, and the Christmas dinner. But I wasn't born until Boxing Day.
Your parents then, not even a home of their own. They were living with which grandparents? Which
At that time, they were living with my dad's mum and dad and various unmarried brothers and sisters, well, 2 or 3 of them, in a wee council house in Craignewk, Lanarkshire.
And so you were around about sort of 5-ish when your parents moved into their own home. It was their own, it was their a council house, their first home.
And their last home. They lived there all their lives.
That must have been a remarkable sort of flowering of the family to be able to have their own home.
Well, I can remember going at 4 on the 2 buses with my mum to get there. I remember saying to mum, will there be children there? And she said, oh, yes, there'll be lots of children. And indeed there were. And I said, will the children like me? And they didn't much, really. I don't blame them.
They didn't
I didn't
much.
Really know how to be a child properly.
Because you'd been surrounded by adults.
I think so, adults. And I'd been fascinated by listening to grown-up conversation, you know, for 4 years. But I remember my mum, you weren't allowed, for some reason, the walls were distempered and or plaster or something. They were still drying out, so you weren't allowed to put wallpaper on, or you were not encouraged to. So I remember my mum with 2 trays of tinted distemper, one orange and one green. Oh, I haven't thought about that.
Oh.
And she had a pair of stockings, one in each hand, with this tennis ball in it. And she was rolling back and forward in this thing. And then whacking them back and forward on the walls, and you get a lovely Art Deco effect. It was beautiful.
You're saying one orange, one green. The significance of that, of course, is coming from the part of the west of Scotland that you came from. It was notably sectarian.
It was. I was just connecting that just now, but that was obviously not so for my mum, and it never was, because she liked both orange and green. But round about where we lived, I grew up in a family who were, my mum and dad were both Christians, and they were defiantly anti-sectarianism. They thought it was the poison of the west of Scotland.
You were 10 by the time your sister was born.
I was just, yep.
What were your feelings about that at the time?
Oh, enormous delight. She's still my closest friend. I remember being terribly offended because you know how people talked in front of kids? They would say, oh, the older one will be jealous. She'll be very jealous. She's been used to being the only one. And I remember being mortally offended, but of course you couldn't speak up to adults because I just was delighted, you know, with this wee thing, you know, who'd turned up. It was wonderful.
More music, Liz Lockhead. Let's hear your third one. Tell me about this.
Oh, this is one of my favourite songs. And this, I picked this because it reminds me, in a way, of being sung to by my dad, because he could sing, unlike my mum and me. Kirsty, trying to pick 8 Bob Dylans would be so difficult, far less. But I love this one because I get 2 for the price of 1. I get Johnny Cash singing in it as well. And it's a Girl from the North Country.
Remember me to one who lives there, for she once was a true love of mine. See for me that her hair's hanging down, it curls and falls all down her breast.
That was Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash, Girl from the North Country. Your poem 1953 is an interesting one. It writes very energetically about these grown-ups in this new estate, in this new part of chapter of their life opening up, and they're making paths and gardens, and they're heaving great sort of stone slabs to make pathways, and they're making curtains, you say, fit to hang on Coronation Day. Did your parents' post-war optimism extend to what they wanted for their daughters? Were they?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, they were aspirational, were they?
Incredibly aspirational, but not in a pushy way. You know, I remember my mum saying to me when I was going down to sign up for primary school, I remember splashing in a puddle. I can just see my Wellingtons. And my mum said, and your dad and I want you to know that if you want to go into university, we'll make every sacrifice.
And it would have been sacrifices.
Well, I suppose it wasn't so much of a sacrifice because I'm one of that lucky generation who was actually paid a grant to go to further education. I mean, people of my generation, we don't know we had it made. I mean, nowadays people are writing to their relatives to try and crowdfund their education and so on. And the aspirational working class, you know, was just such a strong thing. They'd come back after the war and, you know, they really wanted things to be better.
Did they read poetry at home?
My mum spoke poetry, you know, but they knew bits of Burns. My dad didn't. My dad read to me. My dad read me things like Tanglewood Tales before I could read. My grandmother, her mother, had been a maid in an elocutionist's house and she'd heard all these things and learned them off by heart, presumably while cleaning the stairs. And she said them to me when I was wee. So when I stayed with my gran and granddad, my granddad sang, and when I was 3 and 4, I adored him, so I'd be on his chest and I would say, sing me a sad song, Grandad. And he would sing things like The Drunkard's Ragged Wain, and I would cry. I mean, I enjoyed weepies.
Let's have some more music, Liz Lockhead. This is your 4th.
This is the great Michael Marra again. Michael and I used to do a show together, and he's one of my best friends. He died almost 4 years ago at the age of 60, far too young. Michael wrote this song. In fact, this is the first time I met Michael. About 30 years ago, he wrote this song to go in a show called A Wee Home From Home. And I find it ironic and rather lovely that the iconic Glasgow song is written by a Dundonian. How could I not put Mother Glasgow in? Because Glasgow's my home. And this is Michael singing it.
In the second city of the empire, Mother Glasgow nurses all her wains, and working hard to feed her little starlings, unconsciously she clips their little wings. and Mother Glasgow's sucker is perpetual, nestling the Billy and the Tim. I dreamed I took a dander with...
That was Michael Murray, your good friend, singing there, Mother Glasgow, Liz Lockhead. To be an art student in the mid-60s must have been... Well, rather a thrilling thing, I expect. What were your concerns? What were your preoccupations as a student?
Well, I was an art student and I did want to paint. I wanted to be a painter. It had never occurred to me that I would write things. I found out that I was often not pleased with my drawings, so I started writing long, thin things down the side. And then I would think, well, when I'd type them up, or when my mum would type them up, I would think, they don't have to go to the end of the line. And then I would think, what are they? Well, I suppose they're wee poemy. They don't have a tune. And they're not prose. I suppose they're poemy things. But I did start writing almost immediately I went to art school, and it gradually took over with me. But, I mean, I was preoccupied with getting my hair right and getting a date for Saturday night and things like that, like all girls of that age. I was very self-conscious. I thought I just was wrong for 60s. I didn't look right. I felt, you know, I had the wrong kind of figure and I wasn't like Twiggy. And, you know, when you look back, you think, God, you know, sex and looks are wasted on the young, you know. I was quite lazy in some ways at art school, but I was really, really searching and thinking about the kind of painter that I would like to be, and was floundering desperately. And writing things was... I wasn't floundering in the same way. I felt I was finding out something. I remember my best friend Doreen, she's still one of my very, very best friends, says that the first time she met me, I was on the floor under the coats at the art school, and I was on the floor scribbling away, and she said, what are you doing? And she said, I looked up and I said, I'm writing a poem. And she said, she thought, you know, how pretentious. And then she realised, once we got friends about 6 months later, she thought, oh, she was writing a poem. That's what she was doing.
Liz Lockhead, we're going to hear some more of your musical choices. Tell me about this. This is your fifth disc.
Oh, this is Dusty Springfield. And I think it speaks for itself.
That was Dusty Springfield and Going Back. Liz Lockhead, you first earned a living as an art teacher. Were you a good art teacher?
I was appalling. I was really appalling. I was always coming back on a milk train from Dumfries or something like that and going straight into school with last night's mascara still tangled in my face, having been down doing a reading somewhere and slept on somebody's floor, you know, and wearing the same imitation Bieber dress.
So by that time you were trying to combine writing and performing with teaching.
Yeah, teaching was just what I had to do to earn a living. I mean, art school ending and having to go to teacher training at Jordan Hill, that was a bit of a shock. I knew it was coming, but I got very depressed at that point. I found it very difficult to go into teacher training college.
You've said that in times past, poetry was meant to be written as though, and I'm quoting you directly here, you were posh, grown up, male, English and dead. The choice, as you so often have throughout your career, to write in the vernacular and to say, I'm not going to imitate those people who've been well regarded and gone before, but I'm going to do it my way. That takes a lot of confidence. And I'm wondering where your confidence came from to begin doing that.
I didn't feel confident. I just wanted to do it, you know, and I'm still not confident. You know, I was interested in the vernacular of the posh male English and dead as well. I mean, when I look back at a lot of the things I did and I think that was dumb, you know. How dumb to make your first play about Byron Shelley, Mary Shelley, Mary Shelley's half-sister and a maid and the monster. You know, pretty difficult to stage that. But and how difficult to write, you know, witty people like Byron. I was daft, really. You know, I didn't do that thing that they said that you should do, which is write what you know.
But in your poetry, and you say, you know, writing in the vernacular, you use words like skelp and dreich and that sort of thing.
Only only when it's that's the right thing for that piece of work. I don't hold any brief for Scots, you know.
You don't?
As such. No, it's just language like any other language. I am Scottish and that's a big part of my identity. But I don't think, and you know, accept it. And God, do I love the west of Scotland, you know, the beautiful bits. But it's just one option among others.
Tell me about your next piece of music then, Liz Lochhead. It's your sixth.
This is my philosophy of life, I think. I mean, it's, I think, one of the funniest songs I've ever heard. And it has to represent all the great American song, right? You know, I'm devastated that I've not got Gershwin or Lawrence Hart or any of my favourites or Cole Porter. But I do love Hoagy Carmichael and I just love this song. But it just sums up something very important to realise about life.
Ain't no fish, ain't no flounder, ain't no tuna, ain't no fish.
Holy mackerel, some days there just ain't no fish.
Ain't no perch,
ain't no flounder, you flounder for fish.
Ain't no fish.
And although at times you get a mess full, other days are less successful. Some days there just ain't no fish.
Ain't no fish, ain't no fish.
Some days we'll start mighty fine.
Hoagy Carmichael, some days there just ain't no fish. And I was having a little wonder, Liz Lochhead, during that. Is that about professional life? You know, you put out your net there, you're trying to find the words to write the poem, but it's maybe a little bit of the professional, a bit of the personal too.
It is. It's also on the island, it'll be true, literally true. You know, it's what I was saying about metaphors. They've got to be literally true as well. You know, sometimes you can't get any fish, but definitely, you know, sometimes you can't get somebody to give you a job in the theatre, or sometimes in your 30s you can't find a decent boyfriend. Sometimes when writing, you're trying and trying and trying. Some days it's not working and you're not in control. I suppose it's a song that says you're not in control of your life.
So then, Liz, you were, I think you were around about 38 when you met the man who would become your husband. You met Tom, an architect. Tell me about how you met, because honestly, if you'd been writing a play, you may have written this as the opening scene. It was Hogmanay, wasn't it? Was it New Year's Eve?
Oh, gosh. No, that's the first time we got together.
Oh, I see.
If you know what I mean, Kirsten.
I do know what you mean. You'd met before that.
But I met him just... But I just met him 3 months before that and we just, like, talking to each other.
Right.
I met him, really, at the end of a drawing class that he went to with my best friend, Jerry, from art school. I just went to meet Jerry for a drink in a pub and he was talking to the most gorgeous man I'd ever seen in my life. I knew I fancied him at the time very, very much. And when I got together with him, I thought, this is great, but I didn't know we would live together for the rest of his life.
Right. And so you had this kiss on New Year's Eve on Hogmanay and that was it. You
were a bit more than that, Kirsty.
I know, but it's Radio 4. There are children listening, Liz Lochhead. I've got to be, you know,
yes,
I'm neatly encompassing
remember.
It.
The great thing was, I remember after a couple of days, Tom said, I've got to go home tomorrow because I've definitely got to have a clean shirt and clean my teeth with my own toothbrush. So we made a date for the following week to go to the cinema and stuff like that. And I thought, that'll be fine. Well, just calm down about this. And on the way out the door, I said, although this was in Edinburgh, you could come over to Glasgow to my party on Saturday night. And he said, oh, you're having a party? Well, I was from then on. I had to go back and hoover.
So a long relationship with its... Well, as you describe
24
it,
years.
Yes, Liz, with its ups and its downs, like any long relationship.
But we never ever fell out of love with each other. We never changed our mind.
You were asked to become Macker, which is, we know, is Scotland's version of the poet laureate, not long after your husband had died after a short and brutal illness. And I wonder why you decided to take that job on, because that was a big, big professional responsibility.
Yes, it was just 6 months after Tom died, and I thought, oh, God, you know, I thought, oh, hell, you know, when they said, would you like to be the national poet? And it was my sister that said to me, and she can't remember this, she said, I said, will I do this? And she said, what would Tom say? Which is what you do. I never, ever wanted to write about grief, but as part of the Mackerdom, you know, I just would be asked to do all kinds of things. And, you know, for the National Book League in Scotland, I was asked to do a poem about favourite place. And so I was trying to do my job properly and I kept not being pleased with what I was doing, you know. I would try and write about this place that Tom and I went to all the time and I still go to. It's turned out to be, I just wrote about what we would be doing and at the end what was not happening. And people speak to me about this all the time in buses and tell me their sad stories and so on. I'm glad that I wrote it, but it's probably all I want to... I don't know, but I think it might be possibly all I want to write about grief. I think the thing is about writing poetry, you're trying to get the words down as accurately as you can. Not in a flowery way, but as simply and as truthfully as you can. I'm glad that that poem is helpful to other people, but sometimes at poetry readings, people ask me to read it, and I can't. But I'm glad I wrote
it. And in that 5 years, as you say, things were required of you being Macker.
Yeah.
In that period after the shock and the loss and everything that you were dealing with, when that 5 years came to an end and when you had worked as, I presume you must have been working extremely hard and turning up and doing readings and doing everything that was professionally required of you, at the end of that 5 years, what shape did the grief have in your life at the end of that that period of intense activity?
It can still floor me. Drawing was the first thing that came back in grief for me.
Before the writing?
I couldn't write for ages. But I remember even a month after being up at the caravan. I don't mean I could draw well, but I mean I could lose myself in drawing.
Yes.
I do love performing and I do love being outgoing, but I also need a lot of time to myself and to write. And I do spend a lot of time by myself. So I would probably be quite used to some of the aspects of being on a desert island.
Before we get to all of that, I want you to tell me about this then. This is your seventh piece of music.
Well, this is when I invented a party to invite my husband, who I didn't know was going to be my husband, when I invented a party for him to come over to. This is the thing he danced to. It's Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
That was Marvin Gaye, and I heard it through the grapevine. You said, Liz Lockhead, that was played at the party that was invented to get Tom along to the
party.
Flat.
Yes.
We've come this far, and we really haven't talked at all about all the plays that you've written. You've penned original things for the stage, including Mary, Queen of Scots, got her head chopped off. There was the Olivier-nominated Perfect Days. But you've done lots of adaptations too, and, you know, Molière and Chekhov and so on, difficult, tough, big things that are known and have reputations. It must be a much more collaborative process when you write for the stage, and that seems very different to me from the process of being a poet alone, struggling with the words.
Well, writing your own original plays is not so very different. I mean, in a way, Mary, Queen of Scots, got her head chopped off is a big poem, in a way.
Right.
I mean, there's a story in it and all that. Well, working with Euripides is very good because you've got all the hard work done. You just get the language stuff and the fun. I've done three Molières, for instance. They're all in rhyme in French, so I think they should rhyme when you translate them into English. Or in my case, very strongly Scots-inflected English.
Do you think experience makes your writing richer?
Oh, yes, it's got to, hasn't it? Well, there's got to be some consolation for your boobs going all National Geographic, hasn't there?
Tell me then, how do you imagine your island? Because surely you will have imagined it.
Oh, yes. I'm very lucky in my island. It's the kind of island where breadfruit bakes itself in the sun and falls out of the trees onto your lap, and there's lots of lovely fruit. And these fish are dying to jump into this improvised net that I've had to make out of an old pair of tights or whatever. If I can keep my energy and my creative bit going, then I'll be able to keep my optimism alive that I'm going to be rescued, because I am going to be dying to be rescued. I don't know, I'll be having my second childhood in the island But all the time I'll be hoping to be rescued and taken back to where I can go to the movies, you know.
Tell me about your final piece of music, Liz Lockhead.
Well, my final piece of music, it's got to stand in for all the Mozart I love, and that's got to stand in for all the Sibelius and all the Philip Glass and all the Kurt Weill and all the things I couldn't put in. But after my mother died, my dad and I began to kind of go out a wee bit, now and again, not nearly enough, because he died very unexpectedly, just about a year after my mum died. And that was very tough for both my sister and me. But we went to the opera. We went to the opera and we had a ticket for going back to the opera again, to another one that we never made. I mean, it tells me to keep doing things when it's time. But we went to see Don Giovanni in the Theatre Royal. And it was great, you know, because my dad was, you know, a good singer, you know, just an ordinary tenor voice. But we went to see Don Giovanni. We both enjoyed it very, very much indeed. And my dad said afterwards, thank you for your company.
That was La Ci Darem la Mano from Mozart's opera Don Giovanni, sung by Ferruccio Forlanetto with Joan Rogers. The music was played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Daniel Barenboim.
And that was the most beautiful love song sung by the most faithless rogue ever born. And that's what we should always remember. We only know part of the story.
Let's turn then, Liz Lockhead, now to the books. I give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
And I hope it's a King James Bible.
If you so wish.
Definitely. None of that New English Bible flat thing. No, the King James, please.
Righto. And you get to take another book along with you. What's it going to be?
Well, it's. I wish it could be a fantasy book. I wish it could be the collected stories of Alice Munro, who I first read in Canada 40 years ago. And she just has remained my favourite writer. But if you're going to make it a real book, because all her collected stories would be huge. There's two selected Alice Munro short story books, and one called Lying Under the Apple Tree, which was just a few years old. And she was the first person that I could read again in the depths of grief. And I've reread all these things. So I won't be reading anything new on the island, but I will be, because every time I read an Alice Munro story, it is like a book. And there's always something new. And I would use her to try and teach myself how to write short stories.
And what about your luxury?
Oh, my luxury, that was easy. It's a big kiddies art kit full of cheap felt tip pens and also these wonderful big fat pencils that they do just now, which kind of chubby things. Lots and lots of paper and that, and also glitter and glowy, because I couldn't make anything useful, but I would like to mix sand with glitter and different colours, and just to play about like a kid with both words and stuff, and to have to kind of become the kind of child I was whenever I got into that, the bedroom of my own, New York Till, when I was four.
OK, yeah. That great big art kit then is yours. And which of these discs would be the one that you would save?
Gosh, I think it would have to be Green Grow the Rashes, or by Michael Mara.
It's yours. Liz Lockhead, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much, Kirsty.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.